Access number 27791, Mr. Reuben Hyams, Reel 4. Now, what happened next is, I think we think...
Well, the place was pretty near Aguila, which is the part where the British forces first met the Africa Corps and took a pasting, which resulted in what was called a flap. A flap then was a retreat. Nobody knew exactly what was happening, because it was not like Monty's, where we told what we were doing and where we were going and what happened. But although we were advanced to some extent, we weren't all that advanced that we had to worry about staying with patients. We managed to get all our injured and wounded and sick away, and then we had to move off ourselves. I was left with a small group, and we used an ambulance. That was, and of course, like in all retreats, let's say what it was, retreats, we got cut off from the rest of the company, because there was, although we were in the light section this time, it wasn't a small unit, it was a fairly large unit, comparatively speaking. And finally we found ourselves going along the road which led to Tobruk. We were travelling in the ambulance with the back doors open. So there was an excuse for when we suddenly heard a bang and saw in the distance a copula of one of the German light armoured cars. The bang was a shell fired at us. See, so I don't say they were firing at an ambulance because you couldn't see the red crosses. Well, we've never seen an ambulance move so fast. And he kept driving and driving and driving until there was a shout and halt, and we came up to the barbed wire which surrounded the perimeter. He didn't stop quickly enough. We got a burst of machine gun fire in front of him. But we let this through. And I don't know what the orders were given to the ambulance drivers or the drivers of the vehicles that had picked us up as to where to make for. Well, that's where I ended up with this small group of mates of mine, about six of us altogether.
And where were that's Tobruk?
That was in Tobruk.
So this would be April 1941?
So, yeah, something like that. I mean, dates didn't matter then. I didn't see much of the Tobruk itself, because after reporting, I suppose they called me the senior one, although I was still a private and never reached any other heights. I had to report to an Australian DDMS, then the Director of Medical Services, and he assigned me to work in the hospital on the beach, which at to that time was run by Australians. Well, when I went down, within a few hours, the Australian had disappeared. I don't know, went to another part of the perimeter to run in first aid sections or not. And that's where we were on this. It was had been an Italian barracks. Very long, high, narrow rooms.
This was the one on the beach, near the beach?
The beach, yeah. And of course my recollection is very hazy, because I didn't see a lot of it, because I more or less confined to the section where I was. The food was pretty hackneyed, you know, bully and biscuit.
Tell us a bit more about the hospital. What was it like?
There was a tall building built for heat, you know, high roofs, very narrow, but we had beds either side. It was the ward. We turned the barrack room into a ward. There were toilets, but they weren't working properly, and we still had no electricity. The food was the usual army routine, the bully, a bit, etc., and they cooked it as best they could. But I found the most of was the tea, because the wells had been salted by us as we retreated, as they were retreated. And when you got a cup of tea, and all was fairly reasonable at that time, and it got worse later on after I'd gone, when you got your mug of tea, you find it in three layers. A sort of satin thing at the bottom, a clear colourless liquid in between, and at the top the milk in lumps, and you have to stir it up and drink it quick. And of course, in there was the flies. That was the worst thing in a bloody desert.
What was wrong with the flies? What?
Because wherever you go, you could go 80 miles in a day, travelling at 40 miles an hour or whatever, and as soon as you stop, there'd be three flies on the vehicle. And as soon as you stop, you had a cloud of flies buzzing around your head. In fact, they used to have competitions, those who killed them and trapped them. Well, that was later on. Anyway, I don't know how many weeks he was there. Quite several weeks.
Now, you would say, what about the food? Tell us more about the food.
Food was, I said that, bully beef, etc. The usual army rations. They were doing fairly well at the time. But whether we were getting any more decent food because we were at the hospital and they were on the perimeter, I don't know. Because it was very, very noisy, almost continuous air raids.
Now, what were the air raids like? Were these Stuka raids or other bombers?
To be honest, I didn't look. Mostly, I think they were Stuka because some of the airfields were so close around on the escarpment, the top of the escarpment, that you could hear them starting up at times. I can't say that they ever, perhaps in one instance, made a deliberate attack on the hospital. But they did in one instance, and the ward next to mine was hit. And here I realise now, but not at the time, that I could have been court-martialed and shot. Because the rule was that when an air raid went, those patients, it could be, were put into the slit trenches. And orderlies would stay with them as far as possible. But one man had to be in charge in the ward and stay there. And who was that man? Was the one that was responsible for the war. And I said, although I never reached above the rank of private, I always had the NCO's jobs. I think there was something in the unit itself. Two things. One thing, most of the unit were northerners, Scots and northeastern.
Hang on, finish your story first. Okay,
good. Anyway, as I said, and these air raids were pretty continuous. And I remember one morning particularly, where there was a raid going on, the MO came round, the medical officer came round inspecting them, and we were working in the walls with our tin hats on. There was an explosion and a complete window went past my head and shattered on the wall the other side. Now the worst thing I found about this, that I was frightened. Any man that says, I've said this before and I say it never, always, no man says he's not frightened, he's a bloody liar. But I couldn't show that fear to men that had already been wounded, because those that remained in the ward were those who couldn't be moved. And you can imagine the effect it had on some of them, already wounded and sick, probably going to be hit again when the bombing and the strafing came close. Well, in this particular instance, I said, whether it was a deliberate attack on the hospital or I don't know, but a bomb landed. I could hear the stick of bombs coming down, and it passed us, and it was like in rows, set up in happening. And the next ward was hit, and I heard somebody, Ben, because they called me Ben in the army. I've been hit. Now, I did something that I should never have done under the circumstances. I left my post in the face of the enemy to go and pick up my mate who'd been hit by a piece of shrapnel, going for more tools. He was entitled to be out, I wasn't. Anyway, I gave him dressings and first aid and sent him off to be examined by our clip crew that were dealing with it. It was only later that I realised that I committed a court-martial offence, left my ward, or my post, whatever it may be, in the face of the enemy, and left the ward empty of personnel. Which again is an offence in itself. However, nobody ever seemed to recognise it, and I certainly didn't tell anybody. Otherwise, I probably would have ended up in the brig or a glasshouse somewhere. But this continued.
Now, tell us. Now's the time to tell us about why were you out? Why were you think you were always treated as an unpaid or unrecognised NCO? Well,
first of all, I think basically because the units were all from the north, Scotland and the northeast. Quite a good bunch of lads, though. But the officers, I think, were biased to some extent against it, because there were only about a dozen of us Cockneys. A classic additional prejudice because I'm Jewish. Because I remember going back to perhaps some months beforehand, when they were selecting NCOs, my name was amongst those selected, and as soon as I walked into the interview room, without even talking to me, he shook his head. And I should have guessed then. But still, it's something that I, as a Jew, I've experienced all my life to some extent.
Were you upset by it?
to some to the extent, no, angry. Not I thought, because, well, let's be honest, I've got to be honest with myself. I reckoned I was a very good orderly, and I'd been given all jobs that should have been done by NCOs, at least corporals. And my mate that still with me now, still connect with him, he agrees that there was a prejudice amongst the northerners, amongst the officers and our school. Not one of our boys from Lapland South got promotion. They don't all deserve it, but some of them, obviously some did. Anyway, that's just a by the way.
Now, what was a typical day like in this barracks hospital near the beach?
I was on duty 24 hours a day because they were so short of staff. It doesn't mean I was working all the time. I slept in slit trenches. No, I couldn't sleep in slit trenches on the beach because the sand was only about 2 or 3 inches deep. Solid rock beneath that. So what we used old stretchers that had been damaged and covered with blood and stuff, to build up walls with rocks. We made sangers and slept that way as best we could. Which went on for several weeks, I can't remember how long. Till eventually we were told to gather what kit we had. And one night at midnight, when it was absolutely pitch dark, now I'm night blind to start with, and we were told to move off. We were taken by a lorry down to the beach and over the rubble and the broken machinery and the broken cranes. We clambered on board a destroyer. I don't know how I got on board, and I did proper desperation and made a high speed dash down to Alexandria.
And what do you remember of that?
I mean, if I remember of that, we went through a storm and it was quite a nasty experience. But it was we safely got there. We disembarked and MPs.
And when would this be? May, June? Any idea?
I know we're about 6 or 7 weeks in there. Probably May something. We weren't allowed to keep diaries. I can't tell you. Anyway, we reported back to our unit, and we were given fresh clothing, food stuff. And 2 days later, of course, the unit was repairing now for re-equipping, because we'd lost a lot of equipment. And the sergeant major sent for me. He said, I want you and 5 of your mates again. You've had a tough time, he said, and I'm going to give you a cushy job. There's a hospital train loading down at Alexandria Docks. Of course, the camp we were in was not far from Alexandria. And they're short of staff. It's going to Jerusalem. So all you need is your small kit and your blankets. You go there, you help, you report to the December case medical officer, and he will give you onto the train. He will work the train to Jerusalem, help unload, you stay there, you'll get a couple of leave pass for a couple of days, and you'll come back. So I got my 5 mates together, going to get a cushy job. Down to the docks I go in an ambulance, report to the medical officer, who was a naval officer, and says, oh yes, sign the blood sheet. A volunteer to take part in dangerous. I shit myself. Pardon. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I said, I'm not signing that, so I've done anything about it. God, here come this bloody man running. Briggs open, one or the other. And I finished up on my mates and I finished up on a ship called the Bellray. The Bellray, I think it was Norwegian or Swedish.
So it wasn't a train at all?
No, it was it was a locomotive carrier. The decks and the holds were filled with the railway lines. They were not a transport. I don't mean going from place to place. It was transporting complete trains and engines to be delivered, to run them. And we were loaded down with blankets, rolls of blankets, the flimsy petrol tins, which were now empty and were filled with water, and bully and biscuits. I had to sign for 2 big panniers of medical and surgical equipment. went on board and we were joined by two young medical officers whose knees were still white, which means they hadn't been out there very long. They were as green as grass. We formed two teams, a forward and an aft surgical team. And we were supposed to deal with any wounded going on. Now, we didn't know where we were going. And we finished up in Crete. The Belray was equipped with huge cranes for lifting off locomotives and things. And at one time, we were sent alongside HMS York, who was sunk then in the harbour with a huge hole in its side, to take off some of the guns which to land it for the defence of Crete itself. The original reason for going to Crete was to take the wounded and sick from Crete, from Greece, I mean, who had evacuated, managed to get to Crete and get them back. Well, we were backwards and forwards in this harbour for several weeks, actually.
Backwards and forwards to Crete?
No, backwards and forwards up and down the harbour, doing little jobs. And not all the time, another time when we anchored near the entrance to the little island. And during the day, we'd swing across the entrance as the tide went out. And of course, we were a target for the bombers. In fact, I got a photograph, I think. And this went on for several weeks, so eventually we were pulled into the quay.
So were you getting the wounded from...
No, we were still waiting. We were all waiting there all the time. Well, nothing was happening.
Whereabouts were you waiting?
In Suda Bay, a place called Suda Bay. And... food was getting a bit monotonous. There were no accommodation on board except what the crew had. They were sleeping on deck. However, my son was went ashore one day and climbed up the mountains into a little village. And they had a guard goat. Not a dog, but a goat. It was the size of a bloody horse. And it was on a huge chain. And he came, wow! Well, I don't know which was more frightening. Anyway, we spoke to the villagers in sign language and we asked for food. And all I had on was an Italian pound note. It was like 100 piastres. Egyptian note. Egyptian pound note. And they gave us a meal. They killed a kid and made us a stew. And we went back down to the ship. And there was, I got changed, a load of drachmas. I don't know what they thought that was worth of money, what it was worth. But anyway, we went back on the ship. Well, after several weeks, we pulled into the quay, and we started embarking. Then, there were some coming in from the... We went back to the quay, and there we embarked. They were coming aboard in all sorts of conditions, just the same... It reminded me exactly of Dunkirk, although I wasn't at Dunkirk. Some were only draped in blankets, some had their full kit. They were apportioned a piece of deck with a blanket, and that was their
lot. And where did these come from?
They had come originally from Greece. And some may have been from the fighting in Crete itself, although at that time, all of that was going on was mostly air raids, mostly heavy runs. Almost continuous. After we loaded up, we started off. And we made our way back finally to Alexandria, almost running into the Battle of Cape Matapan. Almost. Just on the edge of it. The crew were very, very good. They gave up their bunks for any wounded or sick that we had. Thank God. We never had to use our medical or surgical panniers, and there was no work for us to do. Apart from the crew, there was another, I think there was a contingent of Australian machine gunners with brain guns, which was the only defence we had against it. And they were called into action several times. On several occasions, they were very, very near misses. And at one occasion, the ship rang like a bell. I remember that. The one outstanding thing I remember of that was...
And they were Italian air raids?
No, it was German. The outstanding one was this that sticks in my mind. The captain had an Alsatian dog. And as soon as the red warning went up, or even before, because all we had was a red flag from the battle signal, this dog would make a dash for the little place under the bridge. And we knew that a raid was coming. However, there was one unfortunate incident while we were loading. I suppose it was funny, really. As I said, every man was allocated a blanket. And as they come on, there was this officer come on. He demanded a cabin. And I said, "There are only cabins." And he said, "Only, sir, it's captain's orders. That's all for you, sir. You can sit there or there, whatever you like, sir, but that's all you're allowed." He placed me under arrest. Along came the captain of the ship, and in no uncertain terms, he was a very good army English. And he told him I'm an effing commander of this ship. He said, "What I go say? You'll take that on there." He said, "There are no cabins on this ship or anything else. Here we've only got soldiers. And this man is acting under my orders, so you can't put him under arrest." Anyway, that was the only thing that happened. We finally got back to Alexandria. I must say, by that time I found my sea legs, and I found the voyage itself rather pleasant, except for the food again, because the only thing we could get hot was tea. The ship's crew allowed us to use their galley.
And what were your living conditions like on the ship?
Oh, we slept mostly on deck. It wasn't too bad, but down in the hold it must have been pretty hot and sticky. Although, of course, it was wide open, the hoists were wide, the openings were where they put the things, you know, well, they call it, I don't know, it's open where they can drop the cargo in. That was all open. And we finally got back to Alexandria, and I was told that we're going back again. I said, "No bloody fear. I'll soon go to the brig." Well, it was only a joke. Anyway, an ambulance queue up, and we knew it was for us, so I had to take the two surgical and medical panniers back to the office, get a receipt for them, and went back to the unit to be greeted by the sergeant major and be placed immediately under arrest for being absent without leave. This is absolutely true.
And why did he think that?
Because he didn't know where we'd gone. He thought we were on the train to Jerusalem. He didn't know where we'd been. Anyway, to cut a long story short, I had to go back down to the embarkated medical officer, and we produced all the proofs. And of course, after that, we needed bathing, we needed a bath, we were shaken, we were hungry, we were dirty. You know, we got cleaned up, new issue of clothing, and went down into Alexandria for the evening. I tried to get drunk. But all I succeeded in doing was making myself ill, because I'm not a drinker. So back to the camp, just as an air raid started, and I remember the air raid's going on, everybody's in the shelters, and I'm sticking out, head out of the tent, being violently sick. Anyway, after that, of course, it was just training and regrouping for the invasion of Sicily. I took part in the invasion of Sicily, landing D-Day.
Now that's a bit of a jump in time.
Yeah, well, there was a week before. I mean, it was just a matter of training, retraining, re-equipping. It is a big jump. And of course, this time we'd moved down.
Weren't you involved in the advance through the Western Desert?
Of course, yes. I've missed that part. Yeah. Look, then, of course, up and down, we joined the Benghazi Harriers. But by this time, of course, we were. Now, oh yes, I've missed a whole lot out. Yeah, the Benghazi Harriers. That was a race up and down the desert, backwards and forwards. Still with a light section. And then one day I don't know whose idea it was, they formed surgical teams, which was one vehicle or an ambulance and a staff car and a very compact team of surgeons, one surgeon, an anaesthetist, and five or six orderlies, a couple of drivers, no cooks, everybody did their own cooking, and we were switched from front to front wherever we wanted. Each time we might be away for 3 or 4 weeks, go back for re-equipping, and back up again.
And what were the surgical teams doing? I mean,
it was life and limb, it's called life and limb. Their idea was, you sometimes within 10 minutes, 12 an hour of being hit, a man could be on the and an operating table, because we did have a generator with us in one van, and facilities for sterilising. And we'd switch everybody, have everybody, Germans, anybody.
And how close to front line would you get?
Oh, sometimes you could hear the fighting very close. Sometimes you get overshots from shells, and occasionally a mortar shell or something. But we never actually attacked ourselves.
What were the most common sort of wounds you were dealing with?
Machine gun, shrapnel wounds from shells. The usual, you know, and mostly were abdomen, legs. Well, there's a whole variety of them. I don't seem to remember a great deal of head wounds, although there must have been. But of course, chest, anyway on the body, and they dealt with them, and we had to look most of them until they were evacuated. Sometimes
that was your job, was it?
Looking after them beforehand. At one time, I was switched to working in the theatre with the actual surgeons. My job was to sterilise, keep everything sterilised. And dirty man. Dirty man's job was to hold the leg and that while they cut it off. Quite an experience.
I mean, what was that like? It sounds awful.
Well, like anything else, it's a job you had to do. Job you didn't like. I mean, I dressed a man with four bullet wounds through his buttocks. Two entry wounds, two exit wounds. Not damage done, but I had to bandage him and dress him so that he was able to use the bedpan without soiling it. And I prided myself on that, because that was quite an achievement in that sense. Anyway, but mostly it was administering morphine, etc., before they moved off. And it was a standard procedure for that. It was usually we'd have a 10cc syringe with a flame from a methylated spirit lamp, filled with a mixture of morphine, so that 1cc equaled a quarter grain. You used to give them 2cc, half a grain, mark it on their card, and off they go. How they got to the other end, I don't know, because most of it was evacuated by ambulances, and you can imagine there weren't always roads, sometimes tracks, sometimes none at all. But what happened to them, we never had any follow-up, very few instances did we have any follow-up in history. Although I'd met one or two faces I knew once I went into the leave at one time, but there were very few people. We never knew what happened to them. We did our best for them, and it was just life and limb. We needed a surgeon, and we had one. I didn't like him, but I was in his team.
Why didn't you like him?
He was anti-Semitic.
Covertly.
I knew, because the jobs he gave me and the things he told me maybe I was too sensitive to this as well. I have to admit that. But
what sort of thing would he make you do?
Well, for instance, there was once a pile of rubbish that had hardened, and I said to him, "I need a pick for that." So he said, "No, you don't. If you can't do it without a pick, I'm going to have you court-martialed for being incompetent."
So that was just unreasonable.
No, I said to him, "But sir, I'm not a qualified sapper." "Don't be impertinent," he said to me. Anyway, to start along. Anyway, when I finally